This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Correlation is not causation, I know, but we talked about ethics at the Federal Reserve on this program yesterday, and then boom, today, new ethics rules from the Fed, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 21st day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been an uncomfortable six or so weeks for the Federal Reserve, caught as it has been in the ethics spotlight after revelations about securities trading by two regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents, and also, as we talked about yesterday, by Fed Chair Jay Powell. Rachel Siegel from The Washington Post walked us through the story yesterday, so we have gotten her back on the phone today after the news this afternoon of new Fed ethics rules. Rachel, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, in a nutshell, what are the new rules at the Fed about trading in securities?
All right, so I've got quite a list here. First, the new rules prohibit the purchase of individual securities. The rules restrict active trading. They ramp up the timeliness of reporting and public financial disclosures Fed policymakers have to make. Fed officials will now only be allowed to purchase diversified investment vehicles like a mutual fund, and even those investments will be subject to tighter oversight. To be honest, the list goes on from there. But the thinking is basically to prevent the kinds of scandals that already happened and remove even an appearance of a conflict of interest moving forward.
Right. So just a very quick clarification. Individual securities means they're not buying or not going to be allowed to buy individual company stocks, right?
That's right.
Okay. The Fed has been, you know, armpit deep in this economy in a way it has never been since March-ish of last year, a year plus something ago. What took them so long to decide that letting this trading happen was a bad idea? It kind of seems like they let the news drive their policy decisions, not economic policy, not monetary policy, but their ethics policy.
You know, I have to say, this is really a day that, you know, deserves a round of applause for people in the Fed press corps. The Wall Street Journal really ripped this story open in September. And once these stories were in the spotlight and revelations about what Kaplan and Rosengren were doing became public, that spurred the Fed to take a look at practices that had been going on for a very long time and not only look at what allowed Rosengren and Kaplan to do what they were allowed to do, but say, okay, is there something broader that we need to completely revamp about the way we've been doing business for a while?
And these are pretty broad new rules. Let me ask you this, though. Fed Chair Powell, in the quote in the statement today, said, you know, we're treating this as a matter of urgency. It's my understanding these rules don't go into effect for a number of months, right?
You know, we're trying to understand the particulars behind the timeline. We're waiting for a lot more details that are going to fill in the top line rules that we got today. But I do think that there's something to be said for the scope of these changes and the amount of time it's going to take to codify them both at the board level and at the regional bank level, too.
We talked yesterday, you and I, about the independent inspector general report that, as far as I know, is still coming. Right. So this is not the last chapter in this story.
That's right. So there are two separate tracks here. There is the independent inspector general investigation that is backward looking. It's looking at whether activity from last year violated Fed ethics rules and the law. That's one track that is out of the Fed's hands. What the Fed did do internally is release these new rules that it has its own control over and that is going to set the tone moving forward.
Super quick. We got about 15, 20 seconds. I have not seen any reporting on reaction from Congress, the Senate specifically. Have you?
Not since the new rules were announced this afternoon. We know that Elizabeth Warren has been quite vocal on issues around Fed transparency, but I haven't seen this ricochet through Congress yet. I guess they're a little busy this afternoon.
Yeah, that's true. Fair point. Rachel Siegel at The Washington Post covering the Fed and a bunch of other stuff. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, little of this, little of that. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. A little energy now, shall we? Energy and the environment, really, by which I actually mean climate change and what we are going to do about it. One thing that's been getting a lot of attention, especially the last couple of years, are these things called carbon offsets, basically credits that you or a company can buy to make up for your own carbon dioxide emissions or, you know, from traveling if it's you or manufacturing if it's a company, for instance. Trouble is, not all carbon offsets are created equal. And that's for sure going to be part of the conversation at the big UN climate change conference that's coming up in about 10 days. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
If I can't pollute less, I'll pay someone else to pollute less for me. That is basically the idea behind carbon offsets. So when some business or other says it's going to be carbon neutral, this is one of the ways it does that, by paying money for a credit that ends up going to some carbon reducing project somewhere in the world.
Some carbon projects are planting trees. Some are focused on regenerative agriculture. Some are focused on the oceans.
Jody Manning directs marketing for Cool Effect, a Bay Area nonprofit that helps people and businesses reduce their emissions and find high-quality carbon offsets. Emphasis there on high quality.
Many, many of the offsets that are purchased by companies are not of sufficient quality.
Gilles Dufran is a policy officer at Carbon Market Watch.
Many of the credits that are bought today do not represent a ton of carbon dioxide. And often that's because it's just very difficult to measure the impact of a project.
A group might claim to be using money to protect a forest that was never in danger of being cut down. Or someone might claim money from a carbon credit is making a wind farm financially possible that otherwise wouldn't be. But how do you make sure that's true? Danny Cullenward is with Carbon Plan, a nonprofit climate science research organization.
That's an extraordinarily tough problem to do in one sector in one country. Try doing it in every sector in every country, and now you have the problem of what a global offsets market should be.
There are standards out there, and there are groups that vet carbon offsets. But Cullenward says there's also a lot of shadiness to sort through. And this comes at a time when the market for carbon offsets is exploding. In 2019, the global offset market was worth $320 million. It is now worth about $750 million, and the year's not over. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
All right, that's carbon offsets. Let's talk power storage now, shall we? Because if we're going to get off fossils and onto renewables, we need to figure out how to store solar or wind power when it's not sunny or windy. So we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler for an update on how we're doing in the storage game.
When I say energy storage, the first thing that pops into your head is a battery, right? Well, it turns out
pumped hydro is actually the most widely deployed means of storing electrical energy.
That's Greg Keolian. He's director of the Center for Sustainable Systems at the University of Michigan.
We pump water up into a reservoir and then bring it down through a hydroelectric turbine and generate the electricity that we need.
And he's not kidding about its use. The Department of Energy says pumped hydro currently accounts for 95% of all utility-scale energy storage in the U.S. But it's only useful where the geography supports it. And it's also difficult to build pump hydro plants because they're dams and have ecological impacts. Okay, so what other solutions are in the pipeline?
Right now, from what we see, the answer is not very clear on what the best solution is.
That's Derek Malapragram at MIT's Energy Initiative. He says there's a lot of money and thought going into storage right now.
It could be battery storage, but battery storage that uses much cheaper materials than lithium.
Because at the end of the day, storage has to make economic sense for all interested parties. A lithium-ion battery might make sense in a sedan, but not a shipping vessel or a power plant. Daniel Abraham at the Argonne National Library outside of Chicago says one of the more interesting storage platforms he's been studying runs on concrete blocks.
Essentially, the blocks are lifted by a crane when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. And then when the energy is needed later, the blocks are allowed to fall, which kind of turns turbines along the way to generate electricity.
The Swiss company behind the technology is called Energy Vault. It's been valued at more than $1 billion. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
It's been a bit more than 6 months now since the American Rescue Plan was signed by President Biden. $1.9 trillion in virus relief and economic assistance. And of that pot of money, there was about $20 billion for tribal governments, the biggest ever investment in Indian country to help manage the pandemic, to help support tribal businesses, and to boost infrastructure. Close to 600 tribes and tribal communities got a piece of that pie, but more than half of the money overall went to just 30 of them. Marketplace's Savannah Marr explains why.
The Aquino Wampanoag tribe is based on the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. It received about $9 million from the American Rescue Plan to keep its roughly 1,400 citizens afloat.
Which we are so grateful that we've received, because we've never received that kind of money.
But Chairwoman Cheryl Andrews-Maltese says she was disappointed when she learned what some other tribes received.
You know, to be honest, it really hurt.
Most of the top beneficiaries have huge populations. The Navajo and Cherokee nations are each pushing 400,000 citizens and netted about $2 billion apiece. But also in the top 10 are some small but economically powerful tribes, like the Mohegan Tribe of Indians, which is close in population size to the Aquino Wampanoag, but received over $200 million.
We're not begrudging tribes' needs, but it can't be at the expense of tribes that have been marginalized.
The Treasury Department divided up the money based on each tribe's population, but also on the number of people each tribe employs. It did not take into account things like COVID-19 infection rates or existing poverty levels.
I think the practical nature of data availability on short notice really drove a lot of the decision making.
Eric Henson is with Harvard's Project on American Indian Economic Development. He says there are major data gaps in Indian country, and so Treasury had to use
what's available already or with rather minimal effort.
Hence, population and number of tribal employees. That second number is highest for some of the most economically prosperous tribes, like the Seminole Tribe of Florida, which owns the Hard Rock Casino brand and employs around 16,000 people. That tribe received $400 million in federal aid. But most tribes' economies are a lot smaller. Take the Eastern Shoshone tribe. It's got a similar population to the Seminole, about 4,000 citizens. But its small casino in central Wyoming isn't exactly raking in cash and has less than 100 people on its payroll. Chairman John St. Clair says Treasury shouldn't have taken that number into account.
That's not fair to the tribes that have smaller businesses. The size of your business is dependent upon the economy in that area.
The Eastern Shoshone tribe received about $22 million from the American Rescue Plan and plans to spend much of it on infrastructure improvements. St. Clair says the aid will go a long way in helping all tribes get back on their feet, but it won't level the playing field. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it definitely summons the spirit.
Spooky season and scary movies, my favorite, not. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 6 points today. That is basically flat, 35,603 for the blue chips. NASDAQ picked up 94 points, about 0.6%, 15,215. S&P 500 added 13 points, about 0.3%, 45.49. The big drag on the Dow today was IBM, off 9.5% after it missed revenue estimates. The drag on IBM seems to be its legacy infrastructure management unit, which has been struggling as clients move to cloud computing. Rival HP had a good day, though. Shares added 6.9%. Hey, remember WeWork, the company that promised to reinvent the way we work? And then 2 years ago, postponed its IPO and jettisoned its founder and CEO in a blast of, oh my goodness, what is that company? Well, finally hit the market today through one of those special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs. Shares up almost 13.5%. Bonds, yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The macroeconomic number of the day today is 290,000. That's how many people filed first-time claims for unemployment benefits last week, down 6,000 from a week earlier, and better yet, the lowest since March of a year ago. So we were thinking this morning, well, how do we cover this today? And somebody, might have been me, said, look, this is going to sound ridiculous, but we've got millions of open jobs in this economy. The unemployment rate is 4.8%, way better than earlier in the pandemic, still higher, though, than in the before times. But do you suppose, this person said, it's possible that this is actually a tight labor market? So we called Elizabeth Crowfoot. She's a senior economist at the Conference Board.
We have a near record 10.4 million job openings. And that's exceeding the 8.4 million Americans that have been reported as unemployed in August.
So when you do the math,
what we have is a very bountiful 1.25 jobs available per unemployed person.
So that's a yes, tight?
Another element of this tight labor market is really the recruitment intensity that's happening.
Which is to say,
generally, the churn in the labor market is more evenly spread out. And with COVID, many workers suddenly stopped working, businesses shut down, then everybody started ramping up again. So all of these employers are trying to hire at the same exact time.
Erica Groshen agrees, mostly. She's at Cornell, also a former commissioner, by the way, of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
I think we are seeing a labor market that is tight in some places, but we're seeing a labor market with a lot of flux.
And also people just leaving the labor force outright.
We are also seeing a decline in labor force participation, and that's not what you would see during a tight labor market.
Now, why does this matter, this whole tight labor market thing? Two reasons, mostly. One, a tight labor market tilts the balance of power in favor of workers and higher pay and all of those things we've been talking about as record numbers of people leave their jobs. But also, it complicates things for the people running this economy.
It makes the judgment of whether or not when to raise interest rates a little bit harder.
Next Fed meeting, should you be curious? 2nd and 3rd of November. All right, real estate. First, a data point. The National Association of Realtors said today sales of existing homes, used homes, is another way I like to think about them. They were up 7% August to September, possibly, the group said, because of a brief dip in already low mortgage rates this past summer. So there is that. Now, a policy point. The Senate Banking Committee held a hearing today on how private equity landlords are changing the American housing market. Firms that bought up foreclosed homes after the Great Recession and have been renting them back to people ever since. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin is on Housing for Us today.
Private equity landlords get a lot of hate, says the Urban Institute's Lori Goodman, especially when they compete with first-time homebuyers.
You're taking homes away from owner-occupants. That's a bad thing to do. Bad, bad, bad.
But she argues sometimes it's good to let firms buy property, especially if renovation is needed.
They can do it more efficiently because they know exactly what they're doing because they've done 1,000 homes like this before.
Admittedly, private equity landlords can be less understanding than mom-and-pop ones.
You're going to be late with your rent, so you bring your landlord a pizza, explain why, and he doesn't file an eviction notice, whereas it's hard to bring an institutional landlord a pizza.
That is an understatement, according to Georgia State University professor Dan Immergluck. When renters miss their payment, the response from private equity landlords is often impersonal, computerized, and brutal.
And if you're even a day late on your rent payment, you're likely to see some kind of eviction notice.
Private equity firms have been actively buying in Atlanta, where Immergluck is based. And with the pandemic, he says they could have more property on their hands soon.
Lots of smaller landlords are distressed financially, have not been collecting full rents, and are in a position where they either need to sell or want to sell.
He says unlike the last housing bubble, this time around, it's likely to be older, multifamily properties up for grabs. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
Let's stay on housing here for a second with a bit of a twist to a horror movie, Candyman, set in Chicago's Cabrini-Green housing project. Candyman came out this summer, a sequel to the 1992 original. It's a slasher film, to be clear, which means regular listeners to this program will know that I have not and will not see it. But it's getting a lot of praise, this movie is, for the commentary it offers on some systemic issues in this economy. Brenton Mock is a staff writer for Bloomberg CityLab, and he is among those praising the film. Brenton, thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
I think maybe the first thing we need to do is set the scene, literally the scene, and tell people what Cabrini-Green was in Chicago.
Cabrini-Green was one of the largest public housing projects in the United States. It is situated just beyond downtown Gold Coast, Chicago. I say it is because there still is a remnant of it that exists. At its peak, it housed nearly 15,000 people. And it was a site of much controversy throughout Chicago history and U.S. history in terms of it being this public housing experiment. All of those high-rises I mentioned were razed, taken down, and were replaced with what you see there today, which is a bunch of luxury tower apartments, high-end retail stores, a movie theater. So that's the story of Cabrini-Green in a nutshell.
And it gets us to your piece about this film. And it is a film you write that has a lot of layers, right? There's racism, urban renewal, there's housing policy and police brutality. You, though, say that gentrification, and, you know, no spoiler alerts, even though I haven't seen this film, there are some people who will. You say that gentrification is the actual villain in this picture.
It sets the stage for the actual villain. I mean, the villain is a slasher whose name is Candyman. He has a hook for a hand. He's kind of he's the ghost of a former Cabrini-Green public housing resident. And so what this modern Candyman version does is it brings you back to that location now that most of that public housing has been cleared out. It's kind of haunted with the ghost of the people who used to live there, you know, who've been replaced by luxury housing and retail. It's definitely referenced as part of the terror, if you will, of not only, you know, why the current location is being haunted and by Cabrini Green, but also the people who live there currently.
It's important to point out that this isn't a film about Cabrini Green specifically, right? It's that broader thing that happens to Black and minority neighborhoods all over this country in every part of the economy where they get cut off and left to die in a way.
I mean, the location and site for most of the movie is in the Cabrini Green footprint, but it does serve as a symbol for kind of this the racial violence of what has happened to African Americans in cities across the United States, where their homes and businesses were taken down either due to government neglect or because the government wanted to put a highway up and just so happened that the public housing projects were in the way. You know, we don't want to romanticize public housing projects like Cabrini Green too much. It definitely had its problems. But this movie, it definitely summons the spirit of, you know, what I call not a haunted house, but a haunted housing policy. In which Black people have been, you know, packed into these public housing projects and then, you know, disappeared and erased from there when the city and the federal government believed that the public housing projects had outlived its purpose.
Brenton Mock, he's a staff writer at Bloomberg City Lab, writing most recently about a film called Candyman. Brenton, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, another one from the If We Stop Talking About This Stuff, We're Going to Stop Talking About This Stuff file. Today, October the 21st, is, according to the National Women's Law Center crunching some Census Bureau data, Latina Equal Pay Day. How far into 2021 that Latinas have to work to make as much as a non-Hispanic white guy made in 2020? 57 cents on the white male dollar is the Latina gender pay gap. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. Not going to be good news for those expecting the supply chain glitches to be transitory. The people we talked to at the Marine Exchange down at the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles for our story a couple of weeks ago say that as of yesterday, there were 103 container ships in port. That beats the record set in September. 71 of them at anchor, just shy of the record also set in September. Bottom line, do not plan on holiday gifts getting there on time. That's all I'm saying. Amir Bimbawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.